Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. So, do you think you know when someone's lying to you? What about if they're lying to you over the phone where you can't see body language and facial expressions? And even more difficult, what if they're lying to you on email? How do you know when somebody's telling the truth, and how do you get to the heart of the truth? Well, body language and lie detection expert Marianne Karinch joins us around 12:40 today, and she'll share tools that she's learned along the way. She's an expert in this subject. To help us figure out the truth. We'll also talk with CEO Brian Fieklow about the dangers of having close relationships in the workplace, especially if you're in a leadership role. But first, your relationship with your pet is very special. It's a bond that is very different than those that we have with other human beings. And when one of our furry family members passes away, people often can't move past the loss. Well, Cole James is here to help. He left a successful career in the entertainment industry after discovering his passion for helping people. And he now works alongside his father, John James, and Russell Friedman. Together, the three of them run the Grief Recovery Institute in Los Angeles and Bend, Oregon, which has helped more than 1 million people rebuild their lives after crippling losses. And together, the three of them wrote the Grief Recovery Handbook for pet loss. So, Cole James, welcome to the show today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Vicki.
And I said, you know, we've had discussions. Russell Friedman has joined us a couple of times on the show, so I'm glad to have you join us today to talk about pet loss, because it is a huge thing. I was staggered by the number of people that at any one time are actually grieving the loss of a pet. The numbers you gave me, that 43 million people a year grieve over the loss of a cat or dog. And then when you add in those grieving the death of exotic animals, we're looking at 63.5 million new pet loss grievers in the U.S. every year. That's staggering.
Yes, it really is. It's almost the most common loss event that most of us will experience, and experience over and over again, unfortunately, due to the short lifespans of most pets.
Yeah, and I was reading this and I was thinking the last time I lost a dog was probably about 20 years ago. And when I was thinking about it, I could feel myself getting upset. So,
sure.
You know, we still carry them with us. So why do we do it? Because I think it's because of the joy that they bring us, but...
Yeah, you know, it's no different. The pet loss book was needed just because we knew it was a really underserved community. We've been helping people through the loss of humans and all their career loss and divorce. We've been helping many grievers for over 35 years, but the people that were not attending our support groups and our personal workshops were the pet loss grievers, and we knew they were there because they would call us and they would email, but they were always scared to be compared with other people working on other losses, so they never showed up. So we wrote this book specifically for them to give them their own book to work through. And to kind of answer your question, we just don't pick up any tools. We don't learn anything about how to successfully grieve and complete what was emotionally unfinished in a relationship, you know, in school or by our parents. There's just not a lot of information out there on it, and that's really where the problem starts.
One of the things that is very common, and this has happened in my own family too, you know, especially when we were children, if we'd lose a dog, my parents would go out and immediately get another dog. Not that it ever replaces it, but it kind of takes your mind off it. You say that's not a really good idea.
Yeah, you know, it's really a tricky situation. I mean, obviously we want to protect and shield our children when they experience a loss, but there really is no protecting or shielding a child after a loss. Being sad after a loss is perfectly natural and normal, and it's something we really need to do. And so when we interrupt that process by directly trying to shield the pain and introduce a new pet and kind of distract from the other loss, we never really get complete with all the unfinished emotional things with the last pet. That just kind of stays in our tummy and does really bad things for us long term. We kind of set that same thing up when we watch our kids go through their first breakup, you know, and immediately we say there's plenty of fish in the sea, he wasn't right for you, she right. wasn't right for you, and we just move right past it. But the body and the soul and the spirit, none of that really likes that method, because grief is cumulative and cumulatively negative. It doesn't just go away. So we want to help people do things with all of those feelings.
And you say there are five actions that we should complete to complete the pain caused by that emotional loss. And the first one is gaining awareness. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so some of the losses are very, very obvious, and we just know right away, hey, this is a loss and this is a grieving event. So a lot of the time, awareness is the griever is very aware of it. Sometimes we weren't taught in society of a loss event. So for instance, a divorce, that would 100% be a grieving event. Career loss, another one. Moving, you know, a couple towns, that's a huge grieving event, especially for children. And so we really want to raise awareness of the over 43 losses that are grief, so that people know, oh wow, I am grieving this loss. So that's awareness. Sometimes it's very obvious, sometimes it's not.
Right. Accepting responsibility, you say, is a number two on the five actions. So talk to us about that.
Sure. So a lot of the time, people are very stuck in the event, and it's a tragic. Almost always, it's a tragic event, and we're stuck, and we feel 100% affected by that event. And at some point, we have to move over to taking 1% responsibility to our reaction to that event. So we don't like to use the word victim, but it's a very trapping place. If I'm at 100% effect of what happened, there's very little hope for me to feel anything but sad and miserable for a long time. So I have to shift over to, okay, I'm going to now take a look at what I can do after this tragic loss. What actions can I take to help feel better? And that's really what we're talking about, is just taking responsibility for what we're going to do after the event occurs.
Right. One of the things you suggest in step number three to identify recovery communications is to actually write a letter to your pet.
Yes, very, very important. But again, we want to go on a kind of a search for what was unfinished. I'll give you a quick example. I have a dog, George. He's magnificent. I love him to death. He's 5 years old. Well, I have two new children. My wife and I just had two children in the last couple of years. So I used to hike with this guy, you know, every day for hours. And in the last couple of years, he's a little neglected in the walks. Well, God forbid, if he were to die tomorrow, that might be something that didn't sit right with me. You know, there was some sadness where I wanted to apologize for, hey, George, this is my dog. You know, I could make a statement of, hey, I'm so sorry, in the last couple of years, we didn't get to hike as much as we did before. I knew you needed the exercise. I just didn't have as much time, and I'm so sorry for that. So there's a whole lot of things like that where there's significant emotional statements that are in our hearts that we really want to get across when someone or a pet dies.
Right, right. You know, I this is weird, and listeners are going to think I'm crazy if they don't already know that, but I actually, if I wake up in the middle of the night, sometimes I get out of bed to go kiss my dog and tell him I love him.
I love that. I don't think you're crazy at all. I do that sometimes myself.
You just never know.
Yep.
So number four, taking actions to communicate, and that kind of goes along the lines of what we were just talking about.
Yeah, so it all culminates in, we've discovered all of the different emotional statements we want to make. We put them in a letter, and then we want to share them with another friend, another living person, someone that we can trust, someone that's going to keep everything confidential, but we need it heard by another person. It really just seems to work best that way. Why, we don't exactly know, but we've just found it's very important to share that contents of that letter with another person.
Right, and somebody who's going to understand.
Exactly.
And then, of course, number five is moving beyond loss, saying goodbye to undelivered communications, and hopefully those steps will have led us to that point.
Exactly. Yeah, the saying goodbye is usually at the end of the letter. It's a very important point. We're not saying goodbye to the relationship. We're saying goodbye to the contents of the letter. It's kind of like after we have this call, you know, I'll say goodbye, and we've just ended that communication. And hopefully, you know, we'll have a relationship down the road and we'll talk again, but we're just saying goodbye to that communication. And a lot of the time for grievers, there's a lot of painful things in that letter, and we want to say goodbye to those painful things. So our emotional relationship, and for many, our spiritual spiritual relationship can continue on. You know, we don't like to use the word closure because we don't want to close the door on someone we loved or a pet that we've loved. And we just want to complete what was unfinished and the pain associated with that loss.
Right. So, you know, I know people, and I'm sure you do too, who've been more upset over the loss of a pet than they have a family member. And just, you know, you don't know what to say to grieving people, whether it's a human or animal that they've lost. What are some of the things you recommend people say?
Yeah, great question. So the most important thing is every relationship on Earth is unique. Therefore, we never know how someone else feels, even if we've had a similar loss. So we never want to rob them of the dignity of the uniqueness of their relationship. So I almost always say, I can't imagine how you're feeling. And if I have a comparative loss, I might say, I can't imagine how you're feeling. I know when I had to put my pet down, I didn't even know what way was up. I was devastated. So I'll tell my truth, but I'll leave them room to tell their truth of what they're going through. So I can't imagine how you're feeling. Very often, you know, I have no words. That's another one because it's the truth.
Right.
You know, you just want to really come from a place of truth versus, oh, don't feel bad. It was just a pet. Or don't feel bad. On Sunday, we'll get a new dog. You know, or, you know, those kind of things just minimize or replace. We just don't want to do that for folks because that can be really hurtful.
Right. So let's talk about what we should tell children because, you know, often if a pet has to be put to sleep for some reason or, you know, they've been gone to summer camp or something, they might come home and that pet is missing. This happened to me twice when I was a very small child. Came home and there was no dog. And
right.
I remember the second time I was five and I ran into the middle of the garden and I was going to run away. I was never going to go home again. So,
mm-hmm.
But how can parents handle that in the best way?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's tricky because we have some age-appropriate things we need to take into consideration. And you can go to your local library or our website or Amazon, and we have a book called When Children Grieve, and we have specific age-appropriate things for different ages. But mostly what we always want to do is tell the truth, again, age-appropriate, but we want to tell the truth. And we can really confuse kids if we make up stories that aren't the truth because they read body language, they read nonverbal, and they trust their intuition. And so if we're kind of telling a fib or, you know, hey, you know, Johnny ran away or something like that when Johnny got hit by a car, all those little things can really mess with little ones. So we want to tell the truth as best we can, age appropriate, but we want to make sure that we don't use words like we had to put George to sleep. Okay, I really like to say we helped George die because if we say put to sleep, then children all of a sudden get really terrified or confused about what sleep means. You know, those kind of things. We just got to really pay attention to language. Again, age appropriate, and you can look in the When Children Grieve book about that. But we just, again, sad things happen, grief happens, and we cannot shield our children from sad events. We just have to lead by example and show sadness ourselves and not be strong for others, which is misinformation that helps really no one. You know, we don't want to run and close the door in our room and hide our sadness from our children. We just want to show them, you know, this sadness is perfectly normal and we can work through it.
Right. Now, this is a tough one, you know, and I had to put my last dog down, which was a very difficult decision because he was actually on an operating table and I had to decide, do we wake him up or do we leave him asleep? And it actually was made a little easier because I already knew before he went in for surgery that there was no way I'd give him chemo. I thought it was cruel.
Right.
So talk to us about, you know, how we handle that kind of decision because it is a very tough one.
Yeah, it really is. And with pets specifically, we are, as pet owners, we're put in that position very often where we have to make that decision. And it's just, it's always a hard one. There's obviously no getting around that. But the thing that we want to really help people do is work and be as emotionally complete with their pet as possible. So when that event or when that time comes, not that the decision's easier, but it's kind of like you mentioned with your story. It's just, it's, you know, it's needed and you can take that action. A lot of the time people will put off, euthanizing a pet because they are unfinished with that relationship and they haven't communicated a lot of things, and so they keep putting it off even though that the quality of life for that animal has long since, you know, passed. And we don't want to do that either, you know. So we just you can work through our book or not our book, but the important thing is communicate with your pet, communicate with friends on how you feel about that pet, the good, the bad, the indifferent, all of those things, and then when that time comes up, you'll have a little more of a clear mind on what really is needed.
Yeah. Coincidentally, I ran into somebody carrying her dog a couple of weeks ago at the beach, and I asked if it was hurt because she'd wrapped it up in a jacket, and she said, no, we brought her for a last walk, which I thought was really courageous of them, and, you know, a nice way to say goodbye, because nobody wants their animal to suffer. You know, we want them to have a good quality of life.
Yeah, that breaks my heart that they did that, but I'm glad they did that because clearly for them that was the right decision, mm-hmm. you know. And we do recommend if you feel that the need to be with that animal after you put them down and for 5, 20, 10, 15, 20 minutes and pet them and talk to them, that's all we would say really normal and natural stuff for a grieving person to do. And so please do that if that's you know what's needed.
Well, as always, Cole, great information in this book. I know the Grief Recovery Institute has put out many, many books. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Just that no two losses are the same, and we don't ever want to compare losses. And like you touched on, pet loss can be devastating and heartbreaking for people. And we just, as friends and loved ones, we want to give them the space and open communication lines to let them decide what they want to do about that loss and not minimize that loss, because pet loss can absolutely be life-changing and life-altering and devastating for people, and we want them to get help if they want that.
Thank you very much, Cole James, for being with us today. The book is called The Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss. And let's tell listeners where they can find you, Cole.
Okay, it's www.griefrecoverymethod.com, or you can find the book on Amazon. And Vicki, thank you so much for having us on.
My pleasure. And please do stay with us. We will be right back, but this time we're going to switch into the workplace and find out why friendships at work might not be such a good idea after all. Please do stay tuned. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, environmental attorney and best-selling author of Righteous Pork Chop and Defending Beef, Nicolette Harn-Nyman returns with insights on how we can fire big food and make sustainable choices for our health and our land. Catch Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair every Monday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern on KKNW AM 1150, and listen to past shows at conversationslive.net.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. 495-7617.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, environmental attorney and best-selling author of Righteous Pork Chop and Defending Beef, Nicolette Harn-Nyman returns with insights on how we can fire big food and make sustainable choices for our health and our land. Catch Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair every Monday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern on KKNW AM 1150 and listen to past shows at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
You've got a friend in me. You've got a friend in me.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And joining me now is Brian Filko, JD. He's a workplace culture and leadership advisor. He is also the author of Driving to Perfection, Achieving Business Excellence by Creating a Vibrant Culture, which is a how-to guide for CEOs based on Brian's own 25 years of executive leadership in public and privately held companies. He's been interviewed by CNBC, Fox News, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, and the list goes on. And he's also been on our show before. And today we're going to talk about the dangers of being too buddy-buddy at work. Brian Filko, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Vicki.
So this is a difficult situation in many cases because we spend more time at work than we do at home. We spend more time with coworkers and employees and bosses than we do with our friends and our loved ones. It's inevitable, isn't it, that friendships are going to form?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the idea of, you know, keep your work and business life separate and there's no place for friendships in the office. That's all theory. It's all well and good as theory, but in reality, that's not what happens. It's not at all what happens. Friendships will form in the office among coworkers. They'll form among supervisors and people that report to them. It's natural and it's bound to happen, but it's how we manage that and how we handle it that's most important.
Right. So let's start with this because, you know, when I was a young manager and I was, I think, 17 and a half when I first really entered management and I was told, do not, you know, you can't be friends with your employees. You have to keep, you know, business and work separate, as you just said. Very difficult. And it took me a couple of years to get that balance there. It didn't mean I couldn't be friendly, but there's a very fine line there. So let's talk about that fine line. Because I'm sure other people struggle with that when they're new to management.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's look at it this way. As a manager, it's our responsibility to know what's going on with our employees' personal lives. Now, does that mean that we have to know every intimate detail? Of course not. But to treat employees as robots, you know, punch in, do your job, and I don't really care what's going on outside the office, that doesn't really work anymore. And I'd go a step further. If you see a dramatic drop in a good employee's performance, consider that maybe there's something going on at home. Maybe there's problems with a marriage or there's an illness or other family issues that could be distracting. So the fact, you know, not being in tune with your employees, to me, is doing a disservice to your employee and it's doing a disservice to your company in your role as a manager. So you have to know what's going on personally, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you cross into the friend zone.
Right. One of the things, let's look at a couple of the points you make. This isn't a country club. And when friendships form, particularly between a boss and employee, it can send a message to other employees that they're not in that in crowd, which can cause a whole set of other issues. So what happens if we do form a friendship with an employee? One of the things obviously we need to do is set very clear boundaries. You know, this is friendship, this is business. How do we set those boundaries?
So if a friendship grows, in the example that we're talking about between a boss and an employee, the best thing to do is have a direct conversation with that employee and set mutually agreed boundaries. This aspect of our relationship does not come into the office. And quite frankly, if you're really friends, those boundaries will be accepted. If the boundaries aren't accepted, then I would ask, are you friends or are you being taken advantage of? Mm-hmm. So the best thing to do is have a conversation. But then you've got to manage your actions. For example, you don't want to give your friend access to information or things going on in the company that they otherwise wouldn't be privy to by virtue of their role or their position in the company. Otherwise, we go back to that country club that you talked about. You've got that group of employees in the know. You've got that group of employees that feel on the outside, and that's toxic.
Right, right. One of the most toxic situations I think I've been in was, I won't say the name of the company, and it was many, many years ago, but it was a company that dealt with a lot of creatives, and there was a split between a vice president and the CEO. And the person that I was working with directly at that time chose to side with the vice president because she thought that the vice president was going to win out. And there was this horrible politicking going on and these horrible cliques formed from it. And it was a really unpleasant situation to be in. And, you know, unfortunately for the person I was working with, she backed the wrong horse because at the end of the day, the CEO just fired the vice president.
Mm-hmm.
but that, you know, that took about a year to get to that point. And meanwhile, everybody who's not in that clique was suffering badly. So how do we, if we're in a leadership role, sort out these cliques and figure out what's going on and put a stop to them?
Well, to the extent that we find out about the cliques, we have to confront the employees directly. This is really all about managing behavior. And in terms of managing behavior, that's getting your company the culture that it needs to develop. But the key is to make sure that your employees know that they're empowered to stop that behavior, because they're going to see the behavior before you will, you know, sitting in an office that's removed. So you've got to make it clear that this type of behavior, these boundaries, are what applies in our company. We don't accept this type of behavior. Because here's what happens. Let's say we get that click, right? And your example is fantastic, where you had two different camps forming, one camp around the CEO, one camp around the vice president. That promotes divisive behavior. And if people are outside of that click, if they're outside of an inside group, they start to feel anonymous. They start to feel like they're a second-class citizen. And then what's going to happen ultimately is you're going to drive some really good talent out the door because those people will go find somewhere where they feel a greater sense of acceptance. And then it goes back to not doing your company any service by allowing these things to happen.
Right, right. Well, so far we've talked mostly about employees and managers, but, you know, situations between peers can get very difficult at times. I've seen this happen where people are, you know, best buds and they go to break together and they go to lunch together and they share their personal lives. And then all of a sudden there's a falling out, which is not easy to deal with when you have to work with that person side by side for the next 5 days. So what advice do you give around peer friendships in the workplace?
Very similar to some of the things we just talked about, in that if a friendship forms, you have to hope that the peers set boundaries. And if they don't set boundaries, maybe it's a conversation you want to insert yourself in. Because if you've got two people always leaving for lunch, you know, if they're both on the same scheduled lunch hour, well, it's a free country. They can go have lunch with who they want. But at some point, it may make other employees feel uncomfortable. And then when that falling out occurs, you know, it has a very good chance of affecting performance. So it's important to set boundaries when those kinds of friendships and relationships occur, because, again, you know, as you said, if things do fall apart and if the friendship goes south, you can't let your company's performance suffer as a result. And unmanaged, it surely will. I've seen this in my own organization.
Mm-hmm. What about office romances? Good idea or not? I say not, but that's from personal experience when I was really young.
Well, you know, once again, it's like how we started, where the idea is, you know, keep your work and business life separate and don't get involved in your employees' personal matters. And, you know, avoiding office romances is another one of those things that is a good idea, right? But it doesn't work in the real world. Romances will form. Now, there's a big downside, especially if the romances fall apart. It's what we just talked about with friendships falling apart, only, you know, many, many times worse. So as an employer, we've got to know when that's going on, and we've got to be sure that that romance isn't between, you know, a supervisor and his or her direct report.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important that we know that that kind of behavior is going on, because we have to manage it and be sure that, again, it doesn't spill over and help and create a toxic environment in our company.
Right, right. You know, one of the other things where I've seen issues arise is when a company introduces what they call morale boosting events. And one of the things you talk about is, you know, for example, if your passion is golf, don't assume that everybody's going to be as passionate about it as you. And, you know, because it's going to automatically exclude some people from doing that bonding. Often companies will do that kind of thing to, you know, a form of bond. But you've got to find something that, that works for most people. You've got to speak to what motivates individuals. So give us some ideas around if we're not going to do that and we're not going to say, okay, everybody has to play golf or everybody has to, you know, come to the tennis tournament, what are some good ideas around morale boosting?
Yeah, I really hate what I call forced fun, which means that we're all going to do what I like. And the reason I don't like it is I've been in situations and I've seen situations where you've got a passion. And let's just use golf as an example. So if golf's your passion, then do other employees in the company who share the same passion have an inside track, have greater access to you? Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying don't go golfing with people who like to golf. I'm just saying that don't force your passions on the whole workforce. Understand that people have diverse interests. So I'm by no means am I suggesting that you shouldn't do something. I'm just saying you've got to be sure that you're pitching a big tent. So what we've really got to do, to me, it starts in the office, and that's we've got to make ourselves accessible. And if we've got to make ourselves accessible to our employees equally, and people shouldn't feel like, you know, boy, I'm on the outside because I don't share this passion or that passion. So it's less about what kind of an event should I have, what should I do outside of work, and it's more about creating an environment and a culture of accessibility in the office. And that way, you know, if you hit the golf course, it's fine because nobody feels like they're on the outside. And,
right.
And that's really the key to this.
Right. Well, believe it or not, I used to, I had a project once where I, fortunately, it wasn't a very long one, but where every meeting would kick off with a discussion around what was on television the night before. And if you had not watched The Apprentice, Donald Trump's Apprentice, you're in deep water because you couldn't contribute to that conversation. So that kind of was, to me, forced fun because I didn't enjoy it at all.
Yeah, it's a great example. I mean, the forced fun doesn't have to be outside the office. I mean, some people don't watch TV or they watch very little TV. I mean, you ask me what's going on any reality show, and you'll hear crickets. I have no idea. So, you know, again, I appreciate the effort. I appreciate the idea of bonding. I appreciate the idea of kind of starting a meeting off on a little bit lighter note. But just try and be sure that the way it started is as inclusive as possible.
Right, right. So a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with on the dangers of getting too buddy-buddy at work, Brian?
Just that we've got to draw the distinction between knowing our people personally, because that's our responsibility. We have to know our coworkers. We've got to know people that report to us personally, and then knowing when that crosses into the friend zone. And I really, really strongly disagree with the advice that, you know, just stay out of people's personal lives, don't know what's going on personally, because that will affect their performance. But as soon as you see yourself or somebody else venturing into the friend zone, set those boundaries, define those rules, and you should be able to manage both.
Yeah, I think you're spot on that, you know, you do have to show your employees that you care. A simple, you know, how was your weekend or did you pass your exam goes a long, long way in making people feel that, yeah, you do listen to them. So people can find out more about you at drivingtoperfection.com, correct?
That's correct. That's also the name of my book, Driving to Perfection.
Okay, well, thank you, Brian Filko, so much for being with us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Please do stay with us when we come back. We're going to find out if you really can spot a liar. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please stay tuned.
Got a friend in me.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicky and her work at VickySt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, thanks in part to Northwest School of Animal Massage, we cover the world of animals. This week, January 25th, the show will be partially preempted due to sports. We'll air from 9 to 10:30, and it's your chance to hear an encore presentation of the recent interview with Aline Fortgang from Friends of Woodland Park Zoo Elephants. Hear the latest on the zoo's plan to close the elephant exhibit and why it's so important they go to a sanctuary. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, 9 to 10:30 this Sunday, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, environmental attorney and best-selling author of Righteous Pork Chop and Defending Beef, Nicolette Harn-Nyman returns with insights on how we can fire big food and make sustainable choices for our health and our land. Catch Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair every Monday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern on KKNW AM 1150 and listen to past shows at conversationslive.net.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
You can't hide your lying eyes.
And what a perfect song to introduce our next guest. Thank you, Taylor. Taylor's helping us out today while Eric has a day off.
Of course.
Thank you so much for that. Your lying eyes. And we are going to talk about nothing but the truth with Marianne Karinch. She's conducted seminars in body language and lie detection for the International Spy Museum, for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, George Mason University, and the Colorado Association of Code Enforcement Officials, among many other officials. She's the author of 22 books, most of which focus on human behavior, including How to Spot a Liar, I Can Read You Like a Book. I like that one. And
right.
The Body Language Handbook. And the book we are looking at today is Nothing But the Truth, Secrets from Top Intelligent Experts to Control Conversations and Get the Information You Need. Marianne Karinch, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Vicky. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So I'm curious, because you used to work in professional theater and event raising, fundraising, and then you got into communications for a lobbyist. How did you get into and become so involved in body language and lie detection?
The background in theater and in interpersonal relations in terms of marketing communications and public relations, it all has to do with understanding human behavior, leveraging your rapport building. Theater is a great background for a lot of things, and one of those things is understanding what makes people tick.
Yeah. Well, you say in the front of your book that those who contributed to your book are equally as passionate about the truth as you. And you worked with intelligence professionals, journalists, mental health professionals. I mean, the list went on to get the truth from someone, you know, and they're all passionate about getting the truth from someone. Maybe that's why I'm so interested in it, because we've had a similar kind of background in some ways.
Right. Well, that's what you're after every day.
Yeah.
Every time you talk to somebody, you hope that they're telling you the truth and you have the skills to drive them toward the truth.
So you say to get the truth from someone, you need actually two sets of skills. Firstly, you need interpersonal skills, obviously to create a connection and a rapport. And secondly, you need the ability to assess whether the facts actually fit. You know, is this
right,
making sense? And also to identify the emotions that shape them. So talk to us a little about those skill sets, if you would.
Sure. Facts are part of the truth. They certainly figure into it, but the other things that are very important in getting the truth have to do with human experience and imagination, interpretation, and various other aspects of just our humanity. So I consider truth a feature of humanity. And, you know, the putting it all together is a matter of, really trusting yourself and your analysis, your ability to analyze things and make correlations. So raw facts can often be incredibly misleading, and you will not get the truth. What you need is that human filter of experience and intuition and all of that to put it together and give yourself a whole picture. I sort of look at truth as white light. It's a combination of many, many, many different things, not just a single color.
Right. You say in the book, when people lie when they don't need to, I mean, we'd say, you know, what's the point in lying when you don't need to? But you say in the book, it's all about power.
Right. That is one major reason. There are others. You know, there are people who are just ill.
Right.
And
they
really have a hard time sorting the truth from fiction. But a lot of times people will lie, and it's not necessarily malicious, but they do it to get the upper hand, to show that they perhaps know something that you don't know, or that they just have an edge. And sometimes it's a game, and I've seen people play this game, that they pretend to have information that they only have a marginal amount of information, and
mm-hmm.
they pretend to be experts. We've probably all been exposed
right,
to people like
right.
that.
Too much these days, because, you know, with the internet, you know, so many advantages to it, but unfortunately it exposes us to so many of those kinds of people too.
Oh, right. I mean, have you ever been at a cocktail party and somebody starts talking about eating healthy?
Yeah.
and you know, what do they know about eating healthy? You don't really know. Are you a nutritionist? Are you a biologist? I mean, what are you?
Yeah, we always have to look at the source. Listeners hear me say that all the time. Always look at the source and always look at the money behind the source. Because it's a very driving factor. So let's look at... let's look at the difference between just somebody who lies, you know, for whatever reason, and a pathological liar. You say that people who are pathological liars, actually, their brains are a little different. They actually show more white matter in the brain.
Right. Well, that is the latest research. Now, I'm not going to be definitive about that because it's really recent research, but the recent imaging brain scan, you know, research indicates that there is more white matter. Now, whether or not the person was born with more, therefore has a predisposition to lie, or through repeated lying, for example, in childhood and cultivating lying skills, whether that causes that development, I haven't heard any scientists speculate about that.
Right. Also, you know, we've done several shows with neuroscientists who say that repeated behavior strengthens neural pathways, which
right.
I guess is what you're talking about in the book when you say that repeated lying strengthens the change in the brain.
Right, it does. It does strengthen changes in the brain. So if for some reason you started lying when you were a kid, maybe to protect yourself, you know, there are all kinds of, not negative reasons, but perhaps even a positive impetus why you would feel the need to lie. But if you do it over and over and over again, there's something that you're grooving a neural pathway. Yes.
Right. I like this quote in the book, "Integrity is telling myself the truth and honesty is telling the truth to other people," by Spencer Johnson, the author of Who Moved My Cheese. So let's look at some key tools that will help us get to the information, determine if people are actually lying. And one of the myths I guess I want to talk about here a little is the eye contact thing. Because, you know, as kids we're taught you make eye contact and you can tell if someone's lying. Well, we know that's not necessarily true.
Right. It's not necessarily true because eye contact is, in some cultures, it's minimized, and it's minimized out of respect. In the United States, we tend to be a lot more aggressive with our eye contact, but that's not necessarily the sign of a truth teller. And in fact, some people use eye contact as a way of disguising the fact that they're flat out lying right at the moment.
Right. So what would be some nonverbal cues? And this one, again, I'm going to dispute this one just on my own experience, but we hear a lot about, and you do say in your book that this does vary with people, but some profilers, for example, say this is an absolute fact that if you look up to the right, it means one thing, and if you look up to the left when you're talking, it means another. Talk to us about that.
No, I would disagree with that. That goes back to neuro-linguistic programming, which is a useful tool, but it is not the be-all and end-all of understanding what's going on in the brain. The theory is that you look up left or look up right, depending on whether you are fabricating something or whether you are providing a fact. And that it wouldn't be always left or always right for every human being. The theory is that each human being has a way of searching the brain for either a fact or a construct, and that individual person would tend to, say, always look up left for a fact and always look up right for a construct.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not necessarily true. And if you... you study a great many, many people, you'll find that there are variations all over the place. People will look down or to the side or whatever. So it can help. Yes, it can help you if you have baselined the person. So you need to know by observing that person absolutely telling the truth and observing that person absolutely fabricating something, whether or not that person does have that tendency.
Right. And I tested that on myself after I'd heard that to be true. And I thought, I just don't believe it. So I'm glad you debunked that myth. Thank you.
Right. Oh, sure. No, I mean, neuro-linguistic programming is one of the tools in the toolkit of any interrogator. But at the same time, it's just one.
Mm-hmm. So what would be some clues that somebody's lying to us if we're talking to them face to face?
The big clue is deviation from what's normal, because that shows signs of stress. Now, I want to differentiate between deviation meaning that it is a lie, or deviation meaning that it is stress, because the deviation is a sign of stress. It's not a definitive marker of a lie, but it is the first indicator that you need to look for a lie. So, for example, you and I are having a conversation about your love life, and your voice suddenly starts to go way up, and you start talking a lot faster than you had talked before. And maybe I'm thinking, maybe she's not telling me the truth.
Right.
You know, it's just one of those things. It's a deviation for you. You don't normally sound that way. So what's going on for you? Is it a sign of just stress because you don't want to talk about that subject? Or is it a sign of you're not really telling me the truth right now?
Right.
And that's why you're stressed out.
And so what if we don't know somebody? We don't have that opportunity to build a baseline there.
Oh, you can build a baseline really quickly. You know, in the time that you and I have known each other in this conversation, we've established certain patterns of talking with each other. And if all of a sudden I were to slow down or my voice were to go guttural or something like that, or I were to get very, very strident, you might wonder, well, what's going on for her now?
Okay. Okay. So just, I guess then when we don't know people, we've just got to be very observant about what, how they're interacting with us in those first few minutes, and that's our baseline then.
Right, right. You know, let's take a common situation of interviewing for a job. A person who is interviewing for a job is nervous, wants to put the best foot forward. The person who is doing the interviewing might make that person very nervous. So it's a nervous situation. There's a lot of stress anyway. But when you see that stress, you have to, you know, probe, use good questioning, and try to figure out, is that stress because the person is just, you know, there's so much on the line because of the job interview, or because she's exaggerating her qualifications for this job?
Right. So let's talk about this then, because it's one thing when we can see micro expressions on somebody's face and we can see their body language. And we, you know, we're face to face with voice tone. It's not muffled over the phone. What happens when they're on the phone and email too? I mean, that's a very difficult place, I think, to go ahead.
Right. You're lacking some of the important information, but even there you can detect deviations. Sometime for in a phone conversation, which is what we're having, you can detect stridency. So, you know, the voice tenses up. Well, that's a difference. That's a sign of something going on there, that the person is all of a sudden, you know, tensing up and changing the vocal quality. Pacing would be another one if you're listening to something. Perhaps if the person is generally fluid and all of a sudden is inserting ums and ahs, then you can wonder, is the person just, are you running out of thoughts, or is the person kind of nervous about what I just asked? You know, so you want to go through that in the vocal characteristics. Now, for an email, a lot of times people will redo their emails. They'll either, you know, sometimes you just type it out and that's it. But sometimes you'll look at the email and say, huh, this is a little odd because it seems glitchy. It seems like there was a stop and a start, or there's an extra word in here, meaning that there was some editing going on. Look for those glitches, those stops and starts, to see if perhaps at that moment, why would that person want to edit that?
Okay, good advice. And so, Marianne, we have about 2 minutes left here, but I wanted to look, you talk about 8 conversation motivators. I wonder if you'd just share the top 3 conversation motivators with us that would help us get to the truth in an everyday kind of situation.
Sure. I will give you 3 right off the bat. One is curiosity. You want to use childlike curiosity that we all have, that when you ask someone a question, the immediate sense would be, I wonder, why do you want to know that? Or, who told you that I might know that? There's curiosity on all levels.
Right.
So it's a two-way street, a give and take. And any direct questioning or conversation, you know, you want to stimulate that curiosity. You want to raise it up, because that is your primary tool in motivating conversation, is having some sort of curiosity. It's like an itch that needs
okay.
to be scratched.
Okay. And number 2 would be?
Number 2 would be incentives. We are people of instant gratification. Human beings like instant gratification. So, for example, an incentive would be, I want to know some information from you, so I'm going to give you information. So you might volunteer information. You're going to tell me your secret now.
Okay, that makes sense.
So that's a, you know, sort of instant gratification that also plays on the idea of curiosity.
And then very quickly, number 3.
Silence.
Ah, yes, because it makes people uncomfortable, and sometimes
Yes. They can't stand it and they want to talk.
All right. Well, that's a great note to end our show on. We definitely don't want silence while we're on radio. But
no.
fascinating stuff to read, and I can tell you love what you do. Marianne Karinch, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Vicky. My pleasure.
And the book is called Nothing But the Truth, and there's a lot of research and input in here from people who just have some great backgrounds in counterintelligence and talking and trying to get people to open up. And you can find out more about Marianne and her work at karinch.com, K-A-R-I-N-C-H. And that brings us right to the end of today's show. If you have questions or feedback, you can reach me at info@conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net, or at 800-495-7617. I'm also on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.